Welcome to Raising Confident Kids with SEM, the podcast for parents that want to better understand more about how their child ticks, ease their frustration, and experience a calmer day today. Today, I am talking with Dr. Amy Moore all about ADHD and the five pillars that she uses to gain a deeper understanding and to support children who have ADHD. Dr. Amy Moore is a cognitive psychologist and clinical researcher based over in Colorado Springs in the United States. She's a TEDx speaker. She's a host of the Brainy Moms podcast, and she is both a parent of an ADHD child and has ADHD herself. So she brings incredible insights into ADHD experiences, as well as having all of that incredible research and knowledge to back up that deep understanding that she has of ADHD. I think you're going to really enjoy this episode, and it really gives me some food for thought of things I'm going to take away and implement going forwards in my house too. Enjoy. Dr. Amy, I am so excited to have you on our podcast today. Big welcome.
Thank you so much, Sarah. I was excited when you invited me. You were such a fun guest to have on my podcast that I was excited to have another conversation with you.
Oh, thank you. That's so kind. I think today's topic, all about your five pillars of ADHD, is going to be so important for our audience. I know I spoke to you about this by email before our episode, but here in the UK, it's really variable how long it might take before a child is seen by a medical professional to ascertain and do some assessment on whether or not the child has ADHD. The average wait time here is about 16 months. In the area in which I live on the National Health Service, it takes between 2 to 3 years for assessment. And in Surrey, which is one of the areas where I work, they've actually paused referrals for assessment at the moment. So it can be a really, really long time to wait for assessment unless the family have the resources to go ahead and get a private assessment carried out. And one of the things I really liked when I've listened to you talk about your five pillars of ADHD is that these are things that we can think about, you know, not necessarily just at diagnostic stage, but if we're seeing some characteristics of ADHD, these are still five useful areas for us to think about. Is that right?
Absolutely. Because in America, there's not a lot of consistency in diagnostics either. And so we see overdiagnosis sometimes by general practitioners, and maybe underdiagnosis sometimes with specialists. And so it can be super frustrating for parents who are seeing things that look like ADHD, but they feel paralyzed until they get a treatment plan from a professional. And my five pillars do address things that we can look at all day, every day in our homes.
And before we get stuck into the five pillars themselves, what is it that made you so interested in ADHD as your kind of specialist area?
I love that question, Sarah. So I call myself an ADHD warrior. So I am an ADHD mom and a mom with ADHD. And so
I love that the way you describe it both ways like that. I love it.
Yeah. So I was actually a teacher before I was a psychologist, and I was always drawn to children who were struggling with ADHD because I have it myself. And so I understood that struggle. I understood the plight of the ADHD warrior and how we are frequently misunderstood and how we have strengths that are not always recognized because the focus always seems to be on the struggle. And so I was drawn to the children who were struggling with ADHD because I kind of had that, you know, inside view, like that insider's guide to what was happening. And so then when I became a psychologist, and I'm a cognitive psychologist, so, you know, I focus on thinking and learning. And I thought this is just the perfect opportunity for me to kind of speak into that process, the way we look at ADHD, and some things that we can do to support people with ADHD.
Yeah. And I think, you know, to some extent, you present a really great example of, you know, you're clearly somebody who has an academic career. You have a PhD. We don't always associate academic success with our children who have ADHD or ADHD characteristics. And yet, just as you've spoken to, there's some incredible strengths there that if we're able to work to those strengths and put in the right support, people can still make great progress and achieve great things.
Absolutely. And, you know, something that is misunderstood is that children and adults with ADHD typically have the same IQ as the mainstream population. So it is not an intellectual disability, although that can sometimes co-occur. It's just one part of a struggle. And so if we can support that in some way, then we can function just like everybody else.
Fantastic. So let's talk about your five pillars. I'm really interested in these.
So when I talk about five pillars, it's not just about five ways of treating ADHD or five ways of assessing HD. It's a holistic look, five ways of looking at ADHD. And so if I have a parent come to me and say, I think my child has ADHD, I look at and begin to question based on these five pillars. And so the first thing I ask about is sleep. So I will say, talk to me about your child's sleep patterns or sleep habits. And the reason I ask about sleep is because children with ADHD typically have delayed circadian rhythms, which means that their melatonin production, that hormone that helps us, that tells our body, hey, it's time to go to sleep, that melatonin production is delayed in ADHD. So there's this later onset. So we're frustrated as parents saying, why won't my kid go to bed? Well, your kid's melatonin hasn't kicked in yet. And so when we can recognize that their circadian rhythm is delayed, then we can, you know, make adjustments in their bedtime routine and their behaviors and habits and patterns in the evenings. The reason that sleep is so important for all of us, not just people with ADHD, is twofold. One, as we go about our day, we use up neurotransmitters in our brain. And so neurotransmitters are those chemicals that help our neurons communicate. And as those are used up, they leave behind toxins. And so sleep actually acts like putting our brain through a car wash. I just kind of love that visual. But what happens when we fall asleep is there's like a faucet, right? So this mechanism, like a faucet, allows cerebrospinal fluid to be released and literally wash the brain. So it cleanses the brain of those toxins that build up during the day in all of us. There's also some interesting research, if you follow Alzheimer's research, that's you know, beta amyloid plaques that are associated with dementia and Alzheimer's. There's a little bit of research that suggests that that begins to build up during the day, and sleep helps wash the brain. Right. So that's one reason why we need sleep, because if we've got toxins in our brain because we're not getting enough sleep, then we're, you know, our brain isn't going to function optimally. The second reason we need it is because sleep consolidates memories. So we have to be able to remember what we learn during the day as children. And if we don't get sleep, then we can't consolidate those memories. So we aren't going to be able to think and learn as well as we can.
So what you're saying about sleep is really interesting, because even though our children with ADHD might find it more difficult to be ready to sleep and to fall asleep, it sounds like sleep is just as important for them as it is for everybody else. It would be a myth to think because my child's busy and active, they need less sleep.
Yeah. And actually maybe even more so. And we'll talk about that when we get to my cognitive skills pillar. But memory is already a struggle for people with ADHD. So in order to consolidate memories, we absolutely need that sleep. And so then I'm assuming your next question is going to be, so how do we help? How do we help kids?
Absolutely.
So it's going to be a struggle. And so let me just preface it by saying there's no magic bullet to help your child fall asleep. But one thing we can do is recognize that those circadian rhythms are delayed. And so if it's possible to go with those rhythms especially if you are a homeschool family or your schools start later, then you're able to do that. Unfortunately, if your child has to be up at 6:30 a.m. because their school starts at 7:15 a.m., then you can't push that bedtime back, right? Because we know that kids are going to need at least 10 hours of sleep, 9 to 10 hours of sleep. Okay. Mm-hmm. So if we can get off of electronics at least 1 hour before bedtime, we know that research on the blue light that comes from electronics mm-hmm. also interrupts circadian rhythms. So no electronics at least an hour before bed. Also no activities that stir us up right before bed. Mm. So let's not chase our child around the house, getting their energy out.
Because I've definitely told my husband off. I've definitely said to my husband, stop doing that.
Right. Well, instinctively we think, oh, let's tire them out. Right. Mm. So let's play something really active to tire them out. And so active play is super important, but not within a couple of hours before bedtime. And then develop a bedtime routine that is relaxing. So a warm bath, story time for older children, encourage them to settle in with a book and not a book on a tablet. Again, we don't want that blue light. So this is a time where a traditional old paper book is the type that we want to encourage. Weighted blankets are phenomenal. There is something about that pressure from the weighted blanket that kind of grounds the body, grounds the neurotransmitters, and creates an environment of relaxation. Some children can't tolerate a weighted blanket, though. I will say that some children with ADHD have sensory issues, and that's just too much for them. And so you have to kind of experiment with a weighted blanket. Also, try to encourage no lights in the bedroom because we're already struggling with that melatonin production. And so light tells the body it's time to be awake. And so if we can encourage our children to get used to sleeping in a dark room, even though they want that nightlight or that hall light on, it's better for them to be able to fall asleep in a dark room and one that is cool. The sleep temperature in the house should be cooler than the awake temperature in the house. So those are just a few things that you can try to help encourage sleep. The other thing is no one wants to fall asleep with an overactivated nervous system. And so we have to try not to yell at our kids. Like we just can't get angry and yell at our kids. Nobody can fall asleep like that. And nobody should be able to wake up like that either.
Yeah, that absolutely makes sense. Both of my daughters are girls who take a long time to fall asleep. And we had to recognize early on that the amount of kind of take up time and slow down and decompression time that they both need is more than it might be for other children. And so we've had to build a much longer bedtime routine that allows for more of that relaxation and being ready to fall asleep because they just weren't children who could run around until they dropped and fell asleep. They just don't operate that way. They need a lot of time to be ready to sleep.
Yeah. And I know it's really hard for parents. You're exhausted at the end of the day and you're ready for your time, right? So your kids go to bed and you're like, ah, I can sit down and relax in the peace and quiet. And so if we can stop thinking about, oh, as soon as I get my kids to bed, it's going to be our time. If we can stop thinking about bedtime as just this milestone we have to get through every night so that we can have our time. And if we start thinking about it as this critical activity that really helps our children and their growth and development, and we can approach it through that kind of lens of connection, right? Like this is an opportunity for me to spend quality time with my child. And so I'm going to be relaxed. I'm going to be fully present and I'm not going to rush them through it. And so if I want to lay down with my child and read a book with my child or just have a conversation about their day, three things that they were really excited about, three things that they might be concerned about and how can I help to be fully present and stop thinking about that as let me just get through it.
That's great advice. Thank you. Tell us about your second pillar.
Yeah. So the second thing I would ask parents who are concerned that their child might have ADHD or if they already do have ADHD and they're wondering what should I do, I'm going to ask them about nutrition. So I'm going to say, talk to me about your child's diet. And 9 times out of 10, if I say, how much sugar does your child eat? I hear, well, we try, but. So let me talk to you about sugar. There is a myth out there that says we should not give ADHD children sugar because it makes them hyperactive. Okay, that is a myth. There is no solid research that shows sugar makes your child hyperactive. But what sugar does do is it creates inflammation. So we know that sugar creates inflammation in the body. Well, the brain is attached to the body. So if the body is inflamed, so is the brain. So if you have inflammation in your brain, then your neurons cannot communicate effectively with one another. And so we are making our child's lives harder when we allow them to have a high sugar diet. And so that is the first thing I will say to do. Hey, you really need to work on reducing the amount of sugar that your child eats. I'm not saying don't get any sugar, right? But I'll say follow a 90-10 rule. 90% of the time, don't let them have sugar. 10% of the time, let them have cake. Yeah. And then I'll also ask about grains. So glutinous grains, wheat, barley, rye. There is some interesting research that suggests, I'm going to say this in a super simple way, but there's some research that suggests that gluten binds to neurons. And so, again, we are already fighting against neurons that don't communicate effectively in the ADHD brain because the dopamine and norepinephrine neurotransmitter production and use is not normal in the ADHD brain. And so if gluten is binding to those neurons, it's making them hard to communicate. So I say the same thing. Try to reduce the amount of grains that your child is eating.
When people say, you know, when I hear you say, you know, you've got your 90-10 rule, we're aiming for that 90% really good nutritious food, 10%, you know, sugar treats, those sorts of things, I immediately feel defensive. And that's because my youngest daughter eats a very restricted diet, both from a sensory processing point of view, and also there's some, you know, behavioral elements in there as well. But for me, that's really hard. So I'm immediately defensive on that front. But I had some really great advice, which was around, you don't necessarily have to think about that 90-10. What you're thinking about is, what is the next step that I can take to improve her nutrition and get her having a kind of healthier diet? Because of course, she'll lean naturally to those beige, carb, grain heavy, probably more sugar loaded items. And sometimes it's about just making those incremental improvements towards that. So for us, it was focusing on introducing more proteins. You know, that was our next step. And actually in making that one next step of focusing more on introducing proteins that she could enjoy, we saw that she had sustained energy for longer throughout the afternoons. We're having less collapse in the afternoon, but also that she slept better. So sometimes even those small improvements to nutrition do make a big difference.
Absolutely. And you don't have to do everything all at once. So my good friend, Maddie Lansdowne, who is a nutrition scientist, says make one tweak a week. One tweak a week, right? So like I come on shows and I speak at conferences and I give all of these advice tidbits and tips, and I give them with the caution that don't go home and try everything all at once, right? Just make some small changes and see if you see improvements. The number one supplement, nutritional supplement, that kids and adults with ADHD need, based on research, is omega-3 fatty acids. So our brains need fats, right, for the myelin sheath around the neurons to function properly. And omega-3 fatty acids help build up that myelin sheath. But here's the rub. So remember I talked about dopamine and norepinephrine neurotransmitters not being either produced or used properly in the ADHD brain. Well, deficiencies in omega-3 fatty acids changes the shape of the dopamine receptors. So dopamine receptors, their ability to catch or send dopamine, are misshapen with omega-3 fatty acid deficiencies. And omega-3 fatty acid deficiency is highly correlated with ADHD.
Okay.
So to supplement with ADHD could possibly help normalize the shape of the dopamine receptors so that the ADHD brain can more effectively use the dopamine.
Interesting. I wouldn't have thought about supplements. You know, if I was thinking about nutrition, that's not something that I would automatically have gone to. So it's really interesting to add that layer in. We've got our sleep. We've got our nutrition. What else do we need to think about?
So physical activity is the next question I would ask. So I'd say, talk to me about the amount of physical activity your child gets. And so I don't use the word exercise because a lot of times people have this visceral response to the word exercise, right? They think of going to the gym and lifting weights and running on the treadmill for 2 hours. And that is not what I mean. What I mean is, how much physical activity do you or your child get that puts them in an aerobic zone, that gets their heart pumping? And the reason that that's important is because when we are in the aerobic zone with physical activity, our brains produce a protein called BDNF, brain-derived neurotrophic factor. And that protein is like Miracle-Gro for the brain. So it helps our brains produce new neurons and actually help our existing neurons function better. So physical activity is critical for the ADHD brain. And that can look like just playing on the playground, running around, chasing your child, right? Going outside, green time is super important, taking your shoes off, grounding yourselves in the grass, but any kind of physical activity that is fun for your child. And that might be organized sports. That might be martial arts. Anything that your child finds fun and exciting that gets their heart rate up is going to be a benefit.
I think particularly as our children move through school, there is less and less space for that physical activity and outdoor play in the curriculum. And it becomes increasingly important as our children grow older to be, I guess, intentional about making sure that we're providing opportunities for physical activity.
Absolutely. And depending on the school, right, there are some schools, at least in America, that really struggle to work that into their days. So it doesn't have to be organized sports. Just be intentional about helping your child do something active. So the next pillar is stress. And so I don't even ask the question, is your child stressed? Because I know your child is stressed for a couple of reasons. One, most kids are stressed right now. Kids are stressed because of the amount of academic work that they're being assigned. They're stressed because they are overscheduled. They're hurried, whether it's in the morning, we got to hurry to get out the door to school, whether there's conflict because you're not going to bed on time or you're not waking up easily enough, right? Children are stressed. But children with ADHD are chronically stressed because they're struggling. And so the brain does not know the difference between chronic stress and acute trauma. It responds the exact same way. And I cannot empathize.
Yeah.
So, you know, our brains have this amazing threat detection system, right? Where it says, hey, there's something dangerous, like a tiger in the bush behind us. And so it releases cortisol to get us in a physical capacity to fight, flee, or sometimes freeze. To protect ourselves, right? It's a self-protection mechanism built into our brains. And so the same exact response happens with chronic stress than with a real danger. And so if our kids are chronically stressed, then cortisol is constantly coursing through their veins, and that impacts their ability to think and learn. So their amygdala, the emotion center of their brain, hijacks their prefrontal cortex, which is what we need for reasoning and most thinking and learning to occur. And so if they are chronically stressed, that emotion dysregulation, that nervous system dysregulation is going to impact their ability to learn.
Yeah. And I think both their ability to learn in the classroom, but also their ability to follow instructions when they're at home, or to, you know, you're going to have that lower level of frustration tolerance. So, you know, more likely to argue with your sibling or push back on something our parents are asking us to do, all of those sorts of things.
Absolutely. I think that's a super great point. And so it becomes our responsibility then to help our children manage the stress. Mm. And the first thing that we have to do is manage our own stress. So we have to be able to, it is huge. And we don't even think about that, right? We have to be able to regulate our own emotions, because emotions are contagious. We have mirror neurons that when we are in the presence of someone we love, we mimic their emotional state. And so if we are dysregulated, if we are angry or frustrated, then our child's mirror neurons are going to kick in and they're going to be angry and frustrated as well. And so it becomes our job to co-regulate, meaning when we can regulate our emotions, then it helps our child then become more regulated as well. And so we do that passively, right? By taking care of ourselves, learning stress management strategies for ourselves, self-care for ourselves. But then we can also be intentional about teaching children stress management techniques. Mm. So breathing techniques, grounding techniques, some biofeedback, some ways to recognize, hey, I'm becoming dysregulated right now. So, you know, I need to use my breathing techniques or my grounding techniques to calm my body and brain.
There's a couple of points I want to pick up from that. The first is, we know that ADHD can run in families. So like you were describing earlier about being both a mum of an ADHD child and a mum with ADHD, that, you know, the parent may also be experiencing that chronic stress and that low frustration tolerance and difficulty regulating their emotions, which can make it more difficult for them to provide that co-regulation for their child. So definitely that looking after your own needs first and making sure that you have a good outlet for managing your stress and managing your regulation is super important.
Exactly.
Hugely important. I talk about it in a couple of other episodes on the podcast. We talk about it in a couple of other episodes of the podcast with a mum, Emma Cossey. She's an adult, diagnosed as an adult with ADHD. And also there's a great episode on co-regulation with an occupational therapist, Amanda Clifford. So do go and listen to those, because they're, you know, they really feed into what Dr. Amy's talking about today. But the second thing I wanted to mention is that I think sometimes as parents, we underestimate how much support we need to give our children for their emotional regulation. We have our kind of really important checklist of the things we need to do as parents. We're like, I've got to get them to school, I've got to get the dinner made. And we tend to focus on the practicalities of what we need to get done. And we don't necessarily plan or leave space for really proactively and methodically working with our children on building their emotional skills.
Absolutely. And with ADHD, 80% of kids with ADHD have emotion dysregulation. And it's interesting because that's not part of the diagnostic criteria. And it should be, because it is one of the primary struggles that the child has and the adults in the child's environment have with that child. And so recognizing that this is a brain-based struggle, this inability to regulate emotions, hopefully creates a little bit of empathy. We've done brain imaging on thousands of people with ADHD, and we have seen that the connection between the amygdala and the prefrontal cortex is abnormal in the ADHD brain. Remember, the amygdala is the emotion control center of the brain. Mm. And so we have to recognize that there's a, you know, biological, neurobiological reason why our kids with and adults with ADHD struggle with emotion regulation. And then a large percentage have something called rejection sensitive dysphoria, RSD. Mm-hmm. And that is when a child with RSD, highly associated with ADHD, feels like they are being rejected, criticized, or have failed in some way, or have failed to live up to expectations in some way. it creates an enormous amount of intolerable pain. Intolerable pain. And so when you see those explosive emotions, it's coming from pain, fear, disappointment. And so as parents, we have to recognize that and be the soft, empathetic, temperature lowering presence.
Yeah, I mean, that's hit me right in the chest as you've said that. It's really kind of, almost kind of visceral, that kind of, to just imagine your child experiencing that is quite hard hitting.
Yes, and it frequently lasts into adulthood.
Yeah. But also, I think, as you were saying, with the emotional dysregulation not being part of the diagnostic criteria for ADHD, I think that's one of the reasons that we miss girls with ADHD sometimes, because we see that emotional dysregulation. We see that they're children who are sometimes described as easily upset or highly strung or quick to anger. And we recognize they're having some emotional difficulties, but we don't necessarily associate that with ADHD. So we're not looking for the other characteristics.
Absolutely. And we don't always see hyperactivity in girls as well. And so they typically have the inattentive type and fall through the cracks. And I was one of those. I was not diagnosed until college because I was not hyperactive. But I had those explosive emotions. And so, you know, unfortunately, and I'll age myself here, but, you know, in the 70s and 80s, we just didn't know as much about ADHD as we know now. And so now that we know this information, we have to act on it.
Yeah. And I think it's really important when we think about how we support children and young people with ADHD. I was put forward for ADHD assessment just as I was about to go to university, when I had some psychometric testing in the sort of run up to going to university. And there were some things on that indicated, oh, hang on a minute. And so I went for the initial appointment with the consultant, and I landed up not completing the assessment because the understanding at the time wasn't holistic. And it was basically sort of felt, well, I was going off to teacher training college. It wasn't going to be a highly academically demanding curriculum. And so I probably had enough coping or compensatory strategies to be able to get through the curriculum. So I probably wasn't going to need medication or help. So there didn't really seem like a strong drive for why to take that assessment forward. But now that we know so much more about the emotional regulation piece, I can see so much more now why that process might have been useful for me. Maybe not at the time if there wasn't going to be any help forthcoming, but in terms of understanding myself and how I operate, we've just moved on so much.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, the final pillar that we're going to talk about are cognitive skills. And so cognitive skills are those underlying skills that we use for thinking and learning, such as memory, speed of processing, visualization, our visual processing skills, our ability to manipulate images, auditory processing, our ability to manipulate sounds in our language, reasoning skills, and attention skills. And so when those skills are deficient, then we're going to struggle to think and learn. We did this very large study on more than 4,000 children and adults with ADHD. And we created cognitive profiles using a gold standard IQ test, where we looked at the individual subtests that measured performance on those individual cognitive skills that I just talked about. And what we found across the lifespan in ADHD is that attention is not the weakest cognitive skill. Working memory, oh, it was fascinating. I had to run the statistics again.
You didn't trust your own research.
Right. I was like, wait a minute. Look, we got to run these again. Working memory, long-term memory, and processing speed were more deficient than attention in ADHD. And it's fascinating to me that we call this disorder attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, because people with ADHD do not have a deficit of attention. We have too much attention. We pay attention to everything because it's difficult for us to determine what is the most important thing to pay attention to. So that's why the joke about squirrels exists, because we pay attention to everything, everything in our environment. And so if we are looking for an intervention or a treatment that's only focused on improving attention, then we're missing the boat. We are missing the boat on where those cognitive deficits might be instead.
Yeah. And here in England, you know, I've been a specialist teacher for a long time, and there are programs here in England that work on long-term working memory, short-term working memory, auditory memory, things like that. But those programs and interventions tend to focus on supporting children with dyslexia, for example. And they're not necessarily programs that we think, I'm not saying they're not used for children with ADHD, but it's not the go-to. And I think that's an oversight.
Absolutely. And I think that when we get it in our heads that there's only one thing that we need to do for our kids with ADHD, then we're doing our children a disservice. Because if we're looking at ADHD through all five of these pillars, then we recognize that there are five different categories of help that we can do for our children or find for our children.
Absolutely. Really interesting. And I think that, you know, at your center at Learning Rx, you do quite a lot of work on this brain training.
Right. Absolutely. That's our primary focus, is to assess cognitive skill function, determine where are those cognitive skill deficits, and then remediate them, train them, and strengthen them. And again, that's one piece of the puzzle. And so what that does is it reduces the struggle in the classroom when we can improve processing speed, where we can improve memory. And we do train attention as well, even though it's average typically rather than well below average. It's still important to have strong cognitive skills. And so not just at LearningRx, but BrainRx in Europe and around the world. And so we can train anyone, anywhere, either in person or over Zoom, to hit that pillar. Right. But there are things that parents can do too. Board games, games that force kids to use processing speed skills, like Simon and Bop It, and, you know, just games that encourage the development and the engagement of cognitive skills. And in fact, I'll give you a link to a document that we share that says, hey, this game trains or works out these cognitive skills. And so it's a list of 30 or 40 different board games.
Brilliant. I will pop that in the show notes so that listeners can go and check that out. One of the things that I always do with my girls when we're playing games, and I think it's something I don't see a lot of people do, but I really think it helps with bringing children's attention to the skills that we're using when we're playing games, is I give a little narrative of my thinking processes. So if we're playing something like a memory game where I have to look at a picture and remember something that I'm going to be asked a question on, I'll actually narrate what I'm doing. Oh, I can see these things in the picture. I notice there's four flowers. Oh, there's somebody standing next to that person. Or it might even be, you know, a little bit of maths that I'm doing in a game where I'm counting how much money I've got in Monopoly. I'll talk through, oh, I've got three 20s, so I can count in twos, which I know it sounds like I'm being Captain Obvious, but actually pointing out what your brain is doing helps a child to then think, oh, that's a strategy that I can use.
Absolutely. I mean, those are metacognitive strategies that you're empowering your children, you're modeling those. And we know from self-efficacy theory that feedback is critical, right, for closing that loop when you're working on mastery. And so if you're able to make connections between that task and something in their world, then that increases the chance that they're going to be able to take that mastery and apply it in another area. So, you know, as you're, you know, playing a game that works on visualization or visual processing, you could even say, hey, you did such an amazing job visualizing that. How do you think that you could use that on the baseball field tomorrow when you're thinking about where you're going to hit that ball?
Oh, I love that. That's great. I think your five pillars are so useful for giving us these different areas to think about in supporting our children. What would you say to parents who have some hesitancy around things like ADHD assessment? where they're thinking, oh, the teacher's told me that maybe my child has ADHD. I need to go and see somebody about that, but I'm not sure. And I'm not sure if I feel comfortable about that. What would you say to those parents?
Yeah, it's a struggle because a lot of parents don't want their children labeled. And that's a valid concern. But also know that when we have a label that explains what's happening, not only can that be a relief, right, to the parent, to the child, to go, oh, that's why this was happening. So there can be an enormous amount of relief there that then allows you to work on building that empathy. And a lot of times, not knowing is harder than knowing, right? So wondering, is this what's wrong with my child, can be more stressful than getting the diagnosis and saying, okay, now we know, and here are the things that we can start working on. But the other thing is, you don't have to have a diagnosis to help your child.
Yeah.
Right? You can recognize behaviors that are consistent with ADHD and say, oh, I know some things that I can start working on, even if I'm not getting them formally diagnosed. So it's not the end of the world if you don't get a formal diagnosis.
And I think that's such an empowering message, particularly for people who are sitting on long waiting lists, that you don't need to wait until you have that assessment appointment. There are absolutely things that you can start doing today, tomorrow, next week that are going to build skills for your child for the future.
Absolutely. And it starts with empathy, and it starts with looking at those decisions and the way that we interact with our children using that lens of connection, knowing that everything I say to my child, every decision I make for my child is either going to strengthen the connection I have with them or weaken the connection that I have with them. And so for us to take an extra second to ask ourselves, if I say this, is that going to weaken the connection with my child or is it going to strengthen them? And we know that connection is the number one buffer against mental health crisis, the number one buffer.
Wow, and so that's really powerful.
It is.
Really, really powerful. And powerful to, you know, I'm a pretty impulsive person. I'm not sure I think before I speak. But that encouragement to kind of, what you said there was really meaningful. Of course, I want as deep a connection as possible with my daughters. And I think that's a really, you know, insightful way of thinking about it. Because it does make you not necessarily change the message that you're trying to give, but the way that you deliver it.
Absolutely. Because I want to say that doesn't mean that you don't hold your kids accountable. It doesn't mean that there aren't consequences for poor decision-making for your child. It doesn't mean that you're permissive and you let them get away with everything that steps on your toes as well. It's how you deliver that message that matters. You know, in that empathetic, loving, hey, there's a challenge that I need to help you solve. Or, hey, this is a problem. How can we work together to solve it?
That's great. Thank you so much, Dr. Amy, for coming and sharing your five pillars with us. I think that's certainly given me loads of food for thought, and I'm sure it will give our listeners lots of food for thought as well. We're going to put links for people to find you in our show notes, but a little recommendation from me, Dr. Amy has on her website loads of videos for where she's been a keynote speaker at different events, and I loved your TED talk. I thought it was absolutely brilliant, so it's definitely worth going to check that out.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. It would mean so much to me if you would rate, review, and follow now. It will help other frazzled parents to find us and will give us a platform to bring in more guests. Tune in for the next episode when we will continue to navigate neurospicy family life. Bye for now.